Welcome back to The Present Stage, Conversations with Theater Writers. My name is Dan Rubens, and I'm a theater critic, composer, and arts nonprofit leader. My guest today is Ryan J. Hadid, the playwright and performer of Hold Me in the Water, currently running at Playwrights Horizons through May 7th. Hold Me in the Water is a solo show, a genre that Ryan J. Hadid has really specialized in over the past few years. His most recent piece, Dark Disabled Stories, which was at the Public a couple seasons ago, was not actually a solo piece, although it focused on his own stories and monologues of his own stories. He included two additional performers on stage who shared their stories as well. And a lot of what we talked about in the episode centered around the relationship between those two pieces. Dark Disabled Stories really centered on Ryan J. Hadid's experience as a man with cerebral palsy navigating the world that is not built to accommodate his physical needs, and the way that that manifests not only in dating life but also in navigating public spaces, public transportation. But this story, while featuring disability as part of his own personhood and the way that he navigates any social context, is not exclusively a story about disability. And I think that that led to a really interesting conversation about how these two pieces are different, and the way that he, as a solo storyteller, develops work that both can feel universal to audiences while also making audiences that are able-bodied leave with a broader understanding of the social experience of living with a physical disability. And I was really grateful for the ways that he pushed back on some of my questions in this conversation, and was generous enough to sort of help me think through some of my own reactions to the piece. I think that it is still extremely rare that there is theater that really centers the voices and bodies of disabled actors in the way that Ryan J. Hadid's work does, in a way that both welcomes audiences in, no matter their bodies, no matter who they are, but also challenges audiences who come in with any sort of preconceived notion of who he might be as a performer or what this might be as a piece to really dig deeper. And I appreciated his commitment to continuing to do that in this interview. And I hope that you listen and learn and enjoy. So without further ado, here's my conversation with Ryan J. Hadid. Ryan J. Hadid, welcome to The Present Stage.
Hi, Dan. Thank you for having me.
I wanted to start by congratulating you on your Drama League Award nomination that came out yesterday.
Oh, my goodness.
I'm assuming this is your first time competing directly with Denzel.
And George Clooney.
And George Clooney, Robert Downey Jr., Idina Menzel.
Look, it's the Drama League. It's a fabulous organization, and it's a fabulous afternoon. I was lucky enough to be there in 2023 for Dark Disabled Stories, and it's just a big old party. There are all of these people, many of whom you have admired since birth, and then suddenly you're on the stage with them, eating a full meal, facing the whole audience while you eat. and everybody knows that it's probably not going to be them, because there's 50 nominees, right? For one winner, and it's a lifetime award, and you only can win it once. So it's really stress-free. It's not like you don't have a 20% chance. You don't even have you have very little chance of winning. And so you're just rooting and hoping for whoever is going to take that I think it's a trophy, because it's like a very moving experience to watch someone take an award that they know is a once in a lifetime. Really special.
Well, congrats on that. In my recent episode with Mona Pernot, where she was talking about her play, I'm assuming you know David Greenspan, I asked her, since that's about playwrights, sort of what playwrights she wanted to shout out.
Oh
And
my
she
God.
gave you a shout out and recommended people see Hold Me in the Water. And during in the play, you describe a lot of theater dates and theater going. So I'm curious what current to sort of pass the recommendations and shout outs on, sort of what current theater, current playwrights you'd want to give a shout out to or encourage listeners to check out.
Yeah, and I promise I'm not just doing this to be reciprocal, but Mona's play, I'm assuming you know David Greenspan, is one of the greatest solo performances I've ever seen, ever, ever. And David's performance and the direction and Mona's writing all together, it was absolutely brilliant and it made me weep. And it was also the last thing I saw while we were, after rehearsals had ended, but before we started tech, it was the last performance that I witnessed. And going into my own solo show, which is a completely different tone, completely different style, it was exactly the sort of sprinkle of magic dust that I needed. Sort of like David Greenspan blessing me with a magic wand saying, you can go forward and you can do this. And so that is also the honest answer. I have not seen much of what has opened since I started tech because like there is no time.
Sure.
I have no time. I have no energy for that. But just prior to my rehearsal starting, I got to see Liberation, which is by Bess Wohl and directed by Whitney White, and I thought it was splendid. And it also I had an enormous emotional catharsis to the point that people around me at the end were like, "Is this man okay?" I really, really thought that that was a very powerful piece. And let's see, going back. Oh, I mean, these are things that had already closed, but I saw the BAM Streetcar, which was just absolutely shocking and totally brilliant. And I felt like I was hearing that text in a new way, or almost like for the first time. Patsy Farren's Blanche was like out of this world, out of this world. And then I'll point to, it's a big spring for solo work. I'll say that the two sort of big star-driven solo pieces, Andrew Scott and Sarah Snook, both of which I saw and are both completely different in the ways they embody character and in the ways that those stories are told and those adaptations have been built. But they both inhabit them with such virtuosic brilliance and craft. And you can tell that these aren't film and TV stars that are coming out on the stage just because they want a pat on the back for doing that. These are bona fide theater creatures and telling these classic stories in new and bold and beautiful ways. And they're two great performances. And so and those are still running. So I would encourage people to see them.
Yeah, and it's interesting. Three of the shows you just named are solo shows. And since that's sort of the form that you are most known for and sort of most practiced in, I'm curious, sort of what you feel are across those works and your own sort of like the essential elements to a successful solo piece that might be different than a larger cast work.
Well, I'm going to speak mostly to Mona's in this instance, but also to mine and others that I've really enjoyed, and take away Andrew and Sarah, because where I have my specialty, of course, is the autobiographical monologue. Even Dark Disabled Stories, which was not a solo play, was an autobiographical monologue. It had two other performers' biographical monologues that I wrote with them in collaboration. And so, the thing about Vanya or Picture of Dorian Gray is that these are two literary works or two, an adaptation of a stage piece, an ensemble stage piece. But I mostly know and can speak about what I love when I see an autobiographical piece of writing. And that is what Mona's is, even if there are other characters in it, and even if it's performed by a person who is not Mona, it's Mona's story. It's the story of Mona and her friends. It's the story of playwrights in the 2020s trying to seek a way forward and try to make a living in an industry that appears to be crumbling at the seams, at least financially. And what I love most is when I see something, and Mona does this, not to make yourself when you are a character in your own writing, you can't glorify everything about you. You can't, only prop yourself up without sort of also taking yourself down or cutting yourself and your character with a knife and saying, these are what other people think about me, or these are real things that aren't necessarily flaws, but might skew the way an audience takes me in as a character. And in my own work, I do expose flaws about myself. I try to, across most of my pieces, or biases, or moments of unkindness, because you have to show the full breadth of a character. And every time I step out on the stage as Ryan, I am a character of Ryan at that point in time or across time, but on a certain subject or theme that I'm choosing to sort of focus me and the audience on for that hour or 75 minutes. And if it's just like a puff piece about Ryan, nobody cares. Why are they watching? That's not interesting. I'm a full human being, and I make a lot of mistakes on a day-to-day basis, and sometimes I don't treat people the way that I should, or sometimes I make the wrong move or say the wrong thing or make a snap decision that I wish I could go back and fix. And the thing that would be easy to do, I think, if I was a little, if I was more delicate with my image, if you will, is to use the plays, the solo plays, or the autobiographical work to sort of smooth out the flaws or the problematic moments, and erase the things that are unflattering. But I don't do that. I can't do that because that's not the real story. And the more interesting story is if I tell the truth, or if I tell some close approximation of the truth, sometimes heightened even to make myself look worse, because I want to prove a point to the audience, or I want to make the story clearer, and it's easier or better if I say the things that were in my head that I never actually said, or those kinds of things. And I think if it's just you, I'm doing, if it's just, hello, this is me, and here are all the reasons that I'm so great, and here are all the reasons I've been wronged by the world, and woe is me, woe is me. That's just a vanity project. And that's the last thing I want to be known for. That's the last thing I want to make. You can smell when it's a vanity project. You literally can smell it. Or when it feels like a therapy session and you're really just out here on the stage to work some of your own shit out that you haven't worked out elsewhere, and you've brought a paying audience along to watch you do that. That kind of feels masturbatory. What one must do is, why is this for me and them? It has to be for the audience just as much, if not more, as it is for you. What am I giving the audience by telling this specific story? opening this specific door, opening this wound at times, and they need to come away having felt something, having learned something, having experienced something that isn't just about you dead behind the eyes, talking about yourself for the sake of it. Because that might as well be a journal or a blog or a TikTok. No offense to the TikTokers. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, and I'm interested, that sort of flows into another question I had, which is sort of the when you're developing a piece like this, especially if you're performing in it as a version of yourself, you could write it and rehearse it kind of squirreled away, but without and sort of develop the entire production and piece without
No,
any
no, no, no.
collaborators. So
No, 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 no.
I'm
No.
curious sort of at what point in the process you begin to sort of bring other people in. What for a work like this, sort of what are the roles, obviously director, but sort of other people that you sort of bring into the process as you're writing and creating the piece, and how that might differ from a different type of work?
Oh my God. If I rehearsed and I'm sorry, my voice is a little low this morning. If I rehearsed and wrote fully in isolation, I would die. Nothing would ever get made, and I wouldn't do it. I just wouldn't. I wouldn't do it. So it depends on the piece. It depends on the circumstance. It depends on sometimes when I start, I don't know what I'm about to do. Like, I don't even know that I'm about to make something. So let me go show by show of my has been produced or is currently being produced works just to demonstrate like the how they've each been sort of different. Okay, so Why Are You Single is my first solo play, and it began as my senior capstone in college. So that was a situation where I knew middle of junior year that this is what I was going to do, spring semester senior year. And I was an English and theater double major. So I would like bring essays, quote unquote, into the English classes. And be like, hey guys, look at this essay. And people would literally read them in workshop and be like, this isn't an essay. This seems like you're making a theater piece and you've written it in paragraph form or prose, right? I was trying to like double dip a little bit academically, but I knew I needed feedback. I knew I needed workshop time and space. And then when it came time to be in the midst of making my senior project, you know, beginning January of senior year for a performance that was end of March, I did have all of this raw material from the English classes, but I needed to create them and move them into a performance realm. And that I didn't have a director, but I had a faculty advisor. And I also knew that the faculty advisor was not going to be available to sit with me in the middle of every rehearsal or any de every devising or generative session. So I had two dear friends, Margot and Ian, sort of agree to be assigned to my show, even though they didn't really, you know, need to for credit or anything like that. It wasn't part of their mandatory curriculum, but they like literally sat with me in the rehearsal room, classroom, and like watched me just make stuff. And I needed them for accountability. And I was 23 years old, and I knew I needed the, I knew that it wouldn't be made without the human beings. Then you have Dark Disabled Stories, which, you know, for a little while I thought it was just going to be another solo play, but how that came about was twice, not once, but twice in the fall of 2017, I got in front of audiences with no more than a post-it note. Sometimes I didn't even have that. Bullet points of of things that had just happened or had happened in the semi-recent past, but like that I knew had never shared before, but I knew needed to be told. And I went up with no rehearsal both times, and just this is the bullet point, this is the word. You know, it said bus, or it said bathroom stall, or it said doctor or nurse. And I just told the stories in front of, and they weren't paying, to be fair, these people. I think it was either free audience or whatever, but it was like I needed the audience. I didn't have a collaborator at the time, but I needed the audience to tell me what was funny, what was working. It was like a comedian basically working out new material on the road, which they do all the time. But I'm not a comedian. I'm a storyteller, theater artist. I still needed the audience to tell me what I was making and show me what I was making. And I didn't know that it was a play. I just thought it was a set of stories that I might put together or might break apart. And the first time it wasn't recorded, and that was a grave mistake that I'll never make again. And the second time I brought up my iPhone and I recorded it while I was doing it live on the microphone. And by the end of the second time, I had 40 minutes of material and I was like, oh, this is a play. This is a play. This will be a play someday. And that was 2017. Didn't premiere until 2023. And again, over the course of that, it went from being a solo piece, which I started developing with the wonderful director Jordan Fine. And then mid-pandemic, or in the midst of 2020, when we were both on Zoom all everywhere, everyone, but like Jordan was in the UK where he lives, and I was in my parents' house in Ohio. And it just occurred to us, access is the show. Access is Dr. Sybil's stories. How does access manifest? There are many ways, but we think that there will be people providing access. Okay, I think I want those people to be disabled or deaf people with me. I don't want it to be a non-disabled person. And okay, now that we know that they're both deaf or disabled, I want them to also tell a story of their own in the midst of where in the order? I have no idea. How? What are they going to talk about? Who even are they? Like I knew who one of them probably would be, and the other we didn't cast until we were less than a year out from the pub production at the Public with the Bushwick Star. But we knew, oh, the form is changing. Oh, the like it's still autobiographical, but it's becoming something else. And had there been no pandemic, frankly, if there been no pandemic, that show would have gone up in 2021 as a solo play. It just would have been, that's what it would have been. And I think the success of it, really, why it sort of hit and sparked with people and got them so excited, was because there were three people on stage, each helping each other through various modes of communication tell each other's stories. And that was what was so exciting. And what people, specifically within a deaf and disability context, what they had never seen before.
Yeah, and also each of them supporting the audience with access to in different
Yes.
ways that
Yeah.
maybe you couldn't sort of as one body do alone.
Correct. Correct. And so then we take this to Hold Me in the Water, which is the current play. And by 2019, when I was like, I felt myself swimming in this, not to be weird with the water, but like knowing, oh, I've just lived a major life event and I have to, like, this has to be the next thing. Once again, I got up in front of an audience for, I think it was supposed to be 10 minutes. I made it 15 at the Lark. North Theater was holding a queer storytelling night, and I did 15 minutes and recorded it, and that was the first time. No, according to my program note, that's li I'm lying. When I was living this story, like live in real time, Days after one of the major, most romantic scenes, I went into Daniel Alexander Jones' solo performance class as a guest artist, and we had extra time at the end. And I said to the students, "Do you want me to show you how I start something new?" And I did what I tell students most often not to do, which is I told them a story of something that happened 3 days ago. And because I want you to have distance and I want you to have emotional, like the emotional clarity to be able to tell the story instead of the raw dump of everything that you felt. But I also selfishly knew that I wanted to know what I felt and how I felt. And I was on such, at such a high emotionally that I was like, this has to be captured. And they are the perfect audience. And we have 15 minutes, or we have 10 minutes, or we have whatever it was. And so that was the beginning. That was the first time that I had ever sort of documented as something was happening. And then when it was over, I did the thing with the Lark, and North Theater hosted it. And the North Theater said, "Are you going to turn this into a full piece?" And I said, "Well, I could." And they commissioned the play. So that is how that began. And even then, as soon as they said, "You're going to write it," I went to one of my closest director collaborators at the time. And still, but at the time, I went to Laura Savia, who directed Higher You Single and still does when I perform that. And we worked together on it for 2 years. And when she had to step away, I turned to Danny Sharon. And Danny Sharon is the director of that play, also the director of one of my unproduced plays that we hope will be produced someday. But like, I got the commission and I went, "Well, I need a director." It wasn't like I said, "Let me try to make a draft without them." I knew I needed the support and the guidance, especially because everything I felt was so raw and I was documenting raw as such a th I don't know why I keep saying it. But I was capturing something in First Love that I had never, ever come close to even experiencing. And I knew I couldn't do it alone. So I needed the director at that early stage in order to even hope of getting something on the page.
I want to ask you a number of questions, or maybe it's one big question, but
Please, please.
about
I'll go shorter next time, I swear, I promise.
no, that's fine. But I want to ask you about this concept of axis intimacy, a term that comes from Mia Mingus, the writer and advocate. And you introduce the phrase at the end of the show, but it's really sort of at the core of what you're describing throughout the piece. And I read her blog post where she sort of defines and describes what axis intimacy is. But I'd love for you, before I ask you a specific question about sort of how audiences experience that concept, or how I experience that concept watching the play. I'd love if you could just explain for listeners how you understand it in the context of the play.
I mean, I think please go to Mia's blog and read the essay because it's a very big, fabulous kind of encompassing term that, hold on, I need to. Thank you. Sorry, hopefully they can edit that out. But if not, I'm sorry, I coughed in your ears, everyone. Axis intimacy is a big term that Mia so beautifully defines, and it can cover a lot of different kinds of relationships. So when I define it, I literally do define it only for me and the way that I experience that sensation. Really, it is like an internal body connection, chemistry, sensation. It can cover many kinds of relationships, and for me, it has most appeared or made itself known in romantic scenarios where the attraction or chemistry that I feel with someone couples very intensely with that person's comfort, lack of hesitation, and just sort of intuition about relating to my body and relating to my disabled body, helping me in various ways navigate inaccessible environments or the way that they just treat me when they touch me. And you can feel when somebody, when as a disabled person, you can feel when somebody's afraid of physical contact with you. Even if they're like pushing forward and doing it, you can literally sense the hesitation and the sort of kid gloves and treating you like a fragile bird or whatever. And then you can tell the opposite when somebody's just totally comfortable. And it's like second nature to them. And access intimacy, as I say in at the end of the play, can build over time with somebody who you didn't know 1 minute or 5 minutes or 5 months or 5 years ago, and turn into and blossom into this big, giant mode of understanding each other and each other's bodies. But it also can just be there at the start of something immediately. And often when it just happens and it's like, I don't know you, we just met, but you get it somehow. Those moments are the ones that can feel fleeting. Those moments are the ones that can sort of go away because that person is not necessarily meant to stay in your life forever and ever and ever. But it's so rare that it happens with a total stranger. And when it does, that's when I, what is, wh why? What? Where did this come from? How did this happen? And the reason that I don't define it loosely for the audience or name it until the end of the play is because I didn't know. I didn't know the term until I was in the middle of this experience, and I kept going to disabled people like, what is happening to my body? Have you ever had this happen? Do you know what it's like when somebody holds your hand in a certain way? Do you know what it's like when they, you know, unbutton your shirt or make you totally comfortable in your own body? I am comfortable in my own body. I'm not always comfortable in intimate moments with other people in my own body. And this was the pinnacle of that great, like, oh my God, this is, it fits like a glove and I never want to take the glove off. And yet I'm also still trying to be in relationship with somebody and knowing that like we're not all in yet. So like is this glove going to stay on forever or is it going to blow away in the wind? But I had a dear friend who literally we've been texting this morning, Ezra Benes, a brilliant visual artist. I don't, is this an audio only podcast or can they see video?
Usually audio only.
Oh, well, I'll just show you Ezra in my unmade bed. But Ezra did that wonderful painting I commissioned for him. He's brilliant, up there on my wall. And I was having coffee with Ezra, and Ezra said, well, that's access intimacy. And I said, what the heck is access intimacy? And he goes, oh, that's Mia Mingus. Oh, who's Mia Mingus? You know, Mia Mingus. And it all like started unraveling like an onion. And I suddenly there was a word and a way that I could understand this like phenomena that I was living literally for the first time. And so that's why it takes, it is the core of the entire play, but it, you don't, we don't name it until the end because I didn't know what was happening to me. And by the end of the play, I know and understand the magnitude of the experience and the reason that the experience was so meaningful. And it was because of the access intimacy.
And the follow-up question that I had about that and my experience of hearing you talk about in the play, you have a quote towards the end where you say, where your needs become your wants, where access becomes chemistry. And throughout the play, there are a lot, so much in your story, so much of what you talked about sort of resonated with me. And I thought it was interesting to And I'm curious sort of how you think about this. For me as an able-bodied audience member to be like, oh, your story is my story, like that sort of those feelings maybe make sense to me or resonate with experiences that I've had. But then in order to sort of make that leap of resonance, I'm kind of or audiences need to able-bodied audiences are sort of experiencing the idea of access intimacy kind of metaphorically, where it's not about disabled bodies or physical access, but sort of other types of needs being immediately met and understood. And I'm curious how you think about the sort of the balance of inviting audiences to sort of connect and resonate with what you're talking about, but also not to sort of experience disability and access as metaphors, which is obviously not what you're inviting
No,
them
no,
to.
no, 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 no. But I also think we all have access needs. Like we do, whether you identify as disabled or not, people have needs that other people are either equipped to meet or not, or learn to meet over time or not, or can instinctively make without having to be asked or meet, you know. And so that's not a metaphor. What you found and said, I felt that. And I connect to that, or that has happened to me, doesn't become suddenly invalid because I introduce a concept that you think only can apply to disabled people. We like it applies, it can apply to all of us, and or bodies change over time, and or not all disabilities are physical or mobility related, and there might be neuro things happening in even if you don't like name it or identify as a disabled person. Like there just are human things that a partner or a coworker or a best friend or a family member can intuit or again become comfortable and familiar with over time and make something second nature so that, oh, this is the person I want to do that. This is the person who I'm comfortable bathing me should I need that to happen. This is the person that I will let undress me or see my scars or it like it's not a metaphor. It's there and it's real. And the other thing is disability can come in and out of people's lives, A, or come in and stay there, and when you either over time or through some sort of event, you know. So there's a propensity that many in the audience who haven't experienced it from a disabled perspective will at some point in their lives. And the reverse of that, even is, and it's not exactly what you're talking about, but like, it's possible that you have experienced it with a disabled person and not known that you were the other side of it for them, or had not have had it named for you, or they might not have, felt the closeness to be able to say, Dan, you make me feel this way. It's reciprocal. It can happen between two disabled people. It can happen between a disabled person and a non-disabled person. And also, I'm not the Bible on access intimacy, so I'm not like no one is saying it only can exist within these specific parameters. But I'm going to say one more thing, and then I'm going to ask you something. One is obviously in the play, there's a prologue where I am sort of saying hello and introducing myself, but setting the access parameters for the audience and helping them understand what we've done to create an accessible space and an accessible theater experience. And for some people, like for some people, that is modeling access intimacy, who aren't often welcome to the theater or welcomed at the theater. Or it also models like there are things that I'm offering which you might not think you need. You literally might not think you need them, but then you might end up using the access stuff that is provided and not usually provided in a theater space. So that is one way of demonstrating access intimacy at the beginning, before the audience knows what it is and before Ryan the character knows what it is. But in the prologue, I'm not Ryan the character, I'm just Ryan the performer up there acclimating you to the space. So I think that that's those who have a knowledge going in know what I'm doing or understand what I'm doing. And those who don't, hopefully, possibly by the end, you can go back to the beginning and think about that framing and that container. You don't have to, but if you do, it can enhance the first 5 minutes of the experience. And the other thing I want to ask you, I mean, I know this is your podcast and you're the host, but like, what are you talking about when you say, like, I've experienced this before? And like, you have, like, whatever it is, you have experienced it before. And it's not a metaphor, and you don't have to make a leap in order to have that identification. But I'm just curious if you're willing to like share with the class, what was the specific thing that sort of bubbled up for you that felt connected to my experience, even though you yourself are not disabled?
Well, I think just largely the sort of the arc of the relationship that you're describing and
Of
sort
the
of
romance, of the romance.
and I think the experiences of like connecting with someone in a way that feels sort of uniquely like filled with a sort of a mutual under like an immediate mutual understanding. I guess I was particularly curious about sort of how you think about, or if you think about, and maybe it's all sort of part of a collect, like the experience of every audience member, to both be connecting with your story, but also sort of for audience members who don't have an intimate knowledge of disability, or think they don't have an intimate knowledge of disability, to sort of leave with a deeper understanding of how disability might show up in their lives or in the lives of people around them,
Are you sure?
and sort of how like I think I guess I was curious if I left the play only thinking like, wow, that resonated so deeply with me, that story is my story, but I wasn't thinking specifically about disability or physical access. Am I
Then
missing a piece of it?
that's exactly what you're supposed to do and feel. And I think that that is why, I mean, I think that this, I'm inside of it right now, so I feel this very strongly, but I think it's my strongest piece of writing. And I think it's my most universal piece, because whereas in How Are You Single and Dark Disabled Stories, the disability literally is the headline, and in Dark Disabled Stories, it is the title, like underlined capital letters, right? In this piece, it's a love story, and it's a love story. It's a story of first love. We all, if we're lucky enough, have had one, or we've had a great love, or we've experienced a romance. Full, total, mutual, or not, requited, unrequited, or not, right? But there, we all have a sort of point of connection. And I want you to be thinking this story is my story, whether you're disabled or not. And I think that's true in all my work. I want you to be able to like be like, oh yeah, that's happened to me, or of course. But there are both structural and content reasons why you might have felt more distance with the stories in Dark Disabled Stories or Hi, Are You Single? Because it's sort of like, this is the disability experience with a capital D. And or my specific pathway inside of the disability experience, whereas this is a love story. And we also know how, as a collective story consuming society, know how to like take in a love story. I mean, it's one of the great forms of storytelling. And what happens in this show is when disability is delicately woven through from the very beginning all throughout. Of course it is, but it isn't the headline. And whenever it's woven in, it's because I, Ryan, or the character of Ryan in the story, is bringing it forward. Is I'm italicizing or underlining it for a moment or a paragraph or a page. And then we go back to the romance. And because the reality is, between these two characters, of which I'm, both of them, the disability is never a problem in their relationship. It's never something that they have to surmount. Oh, I hate the word overcome as it relates to disability. But I mean is like, it's not like, will he, won't he, will he like me, will he not like me because I'm disabled. It's so clear that like that is not even on the table as a plot consideration. So when I bring it in to the story, it is a view inside myself as a character, or in my mental, emotional interiority. It is not the external. Whereas in Hi, Are You Single and Dark Disabled Stories, disability is the external force. I don't ever think of disability as a problem, but it is the dramatic adversary because of the way the world views it, right? And it is about literally at times, somebody, profiling me in a gay bar or saying some stupid shit, or a literal staircase where there shouldn't be one, or a subway elevator that isn't working. Like, those are external, right? Whereas I'm inside of a romance, the degree to which I had never previously experienced, suddenly someone is holding my hand, and I have to unpack the difference between somebody holding my hand to help me up a step and somebody holding my hand because they want to hold my hand. And so, like, the disability comes in on my own terms. And it's fully there. It fully affects the way that I experience lovemaking. It fully affects, the way that a date can happen and what can happen on a given date because of the reality of my body and my mobility. But like, it's not the story of these two people. And that's why I think you can walk away having never experienced disability before and go, his story is my story. He's talking about me. I have lived this. Because you have. And then I just add extra shades and extra colors that you haven't experienced, but I hope does not alienate your experience. And the beauty of, I think, the story itself and the writing is that you can have your own experience and say, he's talking about me. And then the deaf and disabled audience can go, oh my God, of he's talking about me too. And the colors and the shades that I have added that are for me and for them are even more profound and felt and reverberating. But doesn't invalidate your experience as an audience member either, that we all can have that experience together. And a key ingredient here in this show, but also in the form of Storylo performance and or monologue storytelling, personal narrative, which I learned from my great mentor, Tim Miller, is that you are supposed to. Tim has a quote. When I talk about my first kiss, when I describe in detail my first kiss, I literally want you, Dan, to be imagining your first kiss at the same time. So that there are these two stories happening at once, one in front of you on the stage, or your imagining of the reality of that story in front of you on the stage, and your internal story. How this applies to you, how this showed up in your life. And if you think about it, if there are 200 people seated at Playwrights Horizons, if I've done my job and the magic is working, then you have 201 people at a time conjuring all of those feelings and those stories and those emotions and those memories all at once. And that's why the play really vibrates, is not when you separate yourself from me and say, oh, this is just about him. When you allow it to become about you as well, it heightens everything that's happening.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting. I mean, this is more of just a self-reflective comment. It's interesting that I think my instinct that I sort of was getting at in my initial question about this, that perhaps like my because I've seen your other work that, as you said, does have sort of disability as sort of the central focus, that my experience of like, oh, this is about me, I had then followed with the thought of like, oh, but this shouldn't be about me because I should be like understanding something more deeply about a different lived experience than I have. And I am curious sort of in other contexts or other performers if I would have those same thoughts. So that's, I think, a really interesting
Oh, you
point.
mean if the person wasn't disabled and the writer wasn't disabled, you wouldn't be stopping yourself short of the identification? Is that what you're talking
Yeah,
about?
I wouldn't be challenging, like, am I experiencing this the way that I'm supposed to be?
You are. I mean, I actually don't need you to have that conflict in your own mind.
Right.
But like
Right.
you are supposed to both be fully inside of it as like this is my life too, and hopefully then you also get these wonderful sparkles of coming away with, oh, and I did learn something about somebody whose experience is different
Yeah.
than mine. And the step beyond that is, and the ways in which I might be participating in an experience like the one he's describing, and I don't even know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think my last question for you is in your, not to to give it away, but at one point in the play, you're trying to understand why things didn't go the way you were hoping with someone, and you're
Yeah.
sort of providing this litany of questions or possibilities, and one of them is, do you secretly hate my writing?
Oh my.
And I'm curious, as a playwright who puts so, this is a big question, but you can interpret it sort of however you want, but as a playwright who puts so much of yourself into your text and into your writing, sort of how do you separate sort of who you are on the page and on the stage and as a person.
Yeah, whoa, that is a big question. I think, you know, sometimes the delineation is clear. And sometimes it's not at all, and there isn't one, and I'm up there. And these things happened to me. They did, you know, and the way that I convey them And the style of my writing may resonate with some people and not with others, but like I'm up there saying this is a part of my life and this is my life, and hoping that you'll emote and laugh and clap and cry, right? Like, and that's very literally, like the approval of the audience is a it's like a risky thing, right? So, and therefore, then when you're dating someone and you and they ask to read your work, the other thing is when you're reading my work, you can't hear me saying it. You can't hear the ways in which I turn it over on its head or make something incredibly intense or dark, actually really funny. So your interpretation in your mind, if you don't know my voice well enough yet, could be the opposite of the intention. And it could be based on your own preconceived notions, whether it's about disability or about anything else. And but this is the work I do. Like, I do memoir on stage. It's memoir, it's creative nonfiction. It's funny, but sometimes it's really not, as you've seen now in multiple pieces. And if you're going to intimately relate to me in a romantic way or a friendship way or a family way, it's like, this is it. This comes with the territory. This is the kind of writing that I do. This is the art that I make. And it might not be for everybody. So, like, and what is the person going to say? Like, oh, you're trash, or you are the masturbatory one, or you're putting therapy on the page and I'm so bored. Probably not if they're trying to like kiss you and fuck you, right? But that's where the question comes from. Do you secretly hate my writing? It doesn't directly translate to like, do you secretly hate me? But it is, do you not connect to the form of expression that I have chosen for myself and my career and my life? Or do you not understand it? Or is it weird to you? Or are you afraid? And this isn't, I'm not speaking about the man in the play per se, but I, in my general dating life, as this has come up, because it has, where people will either ask to read something or watch something, and then they do, and then they go, oh, am I going to be the next one? Oh no. Either like, please don't put me in the next one, or make sure you're really nice to me when you put me in your show. Like, and those people who have the ego to think that they're interesting enough to inhabit my work on the stage, those are usually the most boring people and the most uninteresting people. They're the people who are so self-absorbed as to think like, oh, I know he's just gonna write about me and the one night that we had, one time. Like, grow up, get over yourself. If you think you're an interesting story, you're probably not. But it has come up of like, no one directly like has said these words, but I don't want to date you because I'm afraid of being the next piece or being in the next piece. And the reality is, like, this is the story of first love. It happened once. It happened with one individual. So I'm not going to give you a flavor of the day or flavor of the month and tell you every single time and in great detail about every single person that I date or have dated. This one covers a ton of territory all at once, and that's the part of the beauty of the piece. But like, someday, knock on this wood that may or may not be fake at my desk here, there will be a husband and there will be a partner. And just as the great comedians and storytellers do, that person will be a character, just in the way that my family is. They keep recurring, my parents and my brothers and my grandparents and aunts and uncles, and they will continue to. Like, one of my next plays that, cross your fingers, gets produced sooner than later, is a big family play, a la Well by Lisa Krohn, in which the family is on stage with me, right? And like, is the family like dying to be portrayed and thrilled that they're, I'm putting them on stage? Sometimes no, and sometimes yes. Sometimes they're like, make this one about me. Oh, I'm begging. I should be the star, not him or her, And so it's like they want to be perceived and they don't. I think that like the person who is the great love of my life will understand that this is the work that I make, and they will become part of that work. But it's, oh boy, I think the last thing I'll say on this topic is, how do you set, you said, how do you separate yourself? Complicated, because it just happened a week ago and it happened 3 years ago with another person that I dated for a time, which is that the first thing that they saw was me on stage. The first, it's not like we met across the room and hi, and we talked for 2 weeks and then they saw me in a play. No, it was they saw me in a play about myself. And that's complicated too. It led to, the budding of a possible relationship that ultimately didn't pan out. But it necessitates a separation. It necessitates a distinction that the person that you were attracted to was actually the performer. The person that you were attracted to was me charming the pants off of an audience, and me showing you a scope of emotions that are real, but also are highly curated and technically executed, as opposed to me unfiltered and unvarnished, sitting across a table in front of you and speaking from my heart in a personal and intimate way. And so when other people meet the performer first and then think, oh yeah, this is somebody I want to be with, it takes, there's a little bit of relearning, retraining. And do you really want me, or do you want the person in the spotlight? Those are two different people. And when I say it just happened a week ago, I mean that I talked to somebody on Scruff for all of 3 days here and there. And he said, I think I'm going to come see your show. And then he did. And he was very cute and charming. And, we said we're going to get coffee. But also then I had to deal with opening night. And I had to, I have to get through the show. And I have to, like, preserve myself to be on the stage. So there's a push and pull of course I want to make space for a personal life. Also, the next 2 weeks until we close, unless we extend, are the busiest 2 weeks of my year. So there's not a lot of room for Ryan, the person, to go on the date that would, that may very well be very nice, but we gotta hope that the person stays interested until mid-May, and then I come up for air and can go and get that coffee.
Well,
It's not a clear separation, but it is, and that's fine. And I think that's why it works, is that I'm not pretending my name is Todd and that I'm from Iowa. My name is Ryan, and I was born and raised in Cleveland, Ohio, and my parents are Bob and Judy, and here we go. That's part of the way in. That's part of the appeal of the work. So I'm not going to take that away. And you've got to find people in your life who have the confidence Thank you. To not be afraid. To not be afraid. And hopefully not be so. Hopefully it entices them not to be terribly cruel. Because as Nora Ephron, the great Nora Ephron, this is how I want to end. Nora Ephron says that her parents said to her, everything is copy. Everything is copy. Everything has the potential to be material. And it's about how I choose to weave it and who choose to craft it and who I want to portray. But I get to decide, as I say in the play, I get to decide. You don't get to tell me what you think is worth being on the stage. I decide.
Well, thank you so much for deciding to come on the podcast today.
Yeah.
And thank you so much for deciding to create this new important work of romantic theater. And congratulations on the nomination and the rest of your run.
Thank you, Dan. Thank you for having me. I hope you've enjoyed this conversation and that I didn't sound too much like a priest the whole time.
Thank you so much for listening to this conversation with Ryan J. Haddad on the present stage, talking about his show, Hold Me in the Water. If you liked what you heard today, please share this episode with a friend. Please subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Leave a 5-star rating or review. If you want to follow us at the present stage on Instagram, that would be awesome. Please tune in next time for a conversation with Adam Guan, the writer and composer and lyricist of their new musical, All the World's a Stage, at the Keene Company at Theatre Row. That'll be coming up very soon, and I hope you keep seeing theatre and have a great day.